there, Acid Horizon fans. This is one of the last episodes of the year. Thanks for listening. Thanks for being with us throughout the year. We really appreciate it. You can support us in so many different kinds of ways. First, you can support our guests, like our guest today, Aria. Check out her work, all the links related to her in the show notes below. Also, wherever you're listening, if you haven't subscribed, please do so. We would really appreciate that. Right now, we are also working on ways to make our Patreon account more value-added for contributors. If you just want to give a nominal donation, though, of $1 per month, go ahead and sign up today. Also, there's a merch store in the links. Go ahead and check it out for some cool designs. So without further ado, let's talk with Aria Dean on the topic of Blackcelleration. Welcome to Acid Horizon, the theory podcast. Today's guest, Aria Dean, has a Wikipedia page which nicely summarizes her resume, so I will crib some of what is written there to introduce her. Aria Dean is an American artist and writer. She is the editor and curator at Rhizome. She is also a founding editor of November Magazine. Her writings have appeared in various art publications, including Art Forum, The New Inquiry, Art in America, Topical Cream, and Efflux, which is the online publication that features the essay we will examine today. Efflux published Aria's Notes on Blackcelleration in December of 2017, but the ideas presented there still deserve attention in view of the broader event that the year 2020 now encapsulates. Aria, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
So to begin with, could you give us a definition of the term blackcelleration or blackcellerationism? And how does blackcelleration or blackcellerationism stand apart from other forms of racial politics or political economy?
Basically, it argues that if the premise of accelerationism has any, you know, remaining purchase or life in it, it has to rethink capitalism as directly rethink capitalism as racial capitalism is a concept found in a lot of Black studies work, particularly the work of Cedric Robinson. With this, like, the argument is kind of that capital and the processes of chattel slavery and colonialism are, like, inextricably related, and those formations themselves make modern capitalism possible in the first place in many ways. But capital and the process of chattel slavery and colonialism are basically inextricably related, and those formations or those processes make, like, sort of undergird modern capitalism, make it possible in the first place. And then the other portion of the argument is that if we still want to explore the possibility of accelerationism being an adequate, you know, theory of capital in, you know, contemporary moment, we also have to I went back to a lot of early debates around accelerationism, sort of like prior to sort of like left accelerationist project really kind of cohering in a way, like, online. But if we want to sort of remain dedicated to the, like, exploring the possibility of an accelerationist politic, and if, as a lot of that writing at the time argued, if that requires some sort of quote unquote inhuman agent to assist capital in its self-destruction, then the prime entity to achieve this is the Black subject, because of the relationship to capital that the Black subject has. As Frank Wilderson says, that the rape of the African continent really kickstarted Western capital. So that there's this, like, intimate relationship, an unusual relationship to capital that then might offer the Black subject as that inhuman agent, and that kind of hinging on this dynamic where Black people came to the Western world as commodities, not as human subjects.
I'd like to put a finer point on what is meant by the Black subject. I've written here in my questions the figure of Blackness. Mm-hmm. I think you even call it at one point in the essay, the Black in quotes, right? Mm-hmm. So I want to know who or what is the figure of Blackness in Blackcellerationism as you see it. You've argued that the inhuman subjectivity of Blackness finds its roots in the direct relations of force against Black people on the African continent by Western colonizers. And you also assert that the position of the slave has been inadequately theorized in traditional class analysis, and use some other theorists there too, that proletarian struggles supervene upon slavery as a form of primitive accumulation. Given that this is a case, or if we grant that this is the case, how has the role of Blackness informed or changed capital as capital has evolved?
Yeah. In terms of the figure of Blackness, I would say that, it's a kind of, it's tricky, or what I still feel is, like, a tricky argument, and to sort of pin it down. But basically, following in, like, again, Frank Wilderson's writing about this, which, you know, is kind of been deemed like part of the Afro-pessimist line of thinking. He really argues that, like, blackness or the black subjectivity is a structural position. So we're not talking about, like, a black identity or like a cultural experience of being black, or just like, yeah, the notion of, like, let's say myself being a black woman moving through the world, rather the sort of like structural position in the Western world. So what he argues about that position is that it's both to be black in the Western world, or in, let's say, after the slavery, et cetera, is to be both, I guess, like the limit point for our understanding of humanity, so that, like, the sort of the ground upon which sort of white humanity and Western civil society is formulated. So I guess with that, then, the role of blackness over the sort of course of the evolution of capital, the argument that not in inadequate theorization, like the class analysis, doesn't adequately theorize the position of the slave, is again just kind of drawing on Wilderson's argument. But more than just that, it's like inadequate theorization, it's that the very notion of a sort of like class analysis, or, you know, focus on labor relations as has been traditionally offered through, you know, most of like Western, let's say, political and economic thinking. And, you know, specifically he's looking at Marx and early Gramsci's Marx in that essay, that actually cannot incorporate the position of the slave. So it's not like, oh, we need to add an understanding of the dimension of race to our class analysis, but rather the class analysis formed historically the way that it has been logically cannot incorporate the position of the slave. And that's primarily because the slave is not alienated from their labor. They're actually, the slave has no ontological claim to said labor in the first place. Again, due to that information of, you know, what appears to be a human entity in Africa into a commodity, into an object over the course of the slave trade. So with that, then, I think the role of blackness has actually sort of changed not that much over the course of like the history of capital. I think that it's maybe like there's sort of like that blackness kind of continually maintains that boundary, the boundary of the human subject, the boundary of like what's considered a proper, you know, proper engagement in politics, proper engagement in the economy. And capital has continued to shift around blackness, using it in that way to sort of justify itself. But I also would say that now, I think with sort of like rise of neoliberalism, and then also especially with the rise of a digitally mediated social sphere, sort of experience of capitalist subjects has largely continually like caught up to the position of the black over time. My long answer.
No, that's great. It's interesting because it sounds like what you're talking about, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're not just going up the middle between what we understand to be identity politics and class analysis. There's almost like a third position, or a theory that has a relative independence from even both of those categories of theory. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yes, I think so. And I think that, in my view, and I mean, I think this is totally contestable, but this is kind of just the way I've wound my way through this writing. And I think that, like, to me, there's a thread in Black studies that, like, some of which in the contemporary is being deemed Afro-pessimist, some of which has kind of just been, you know, work in Black studies that, you know, hasn't garnered a name separate from Black studies because there isn't that much, like, you know, work to sort of categorize people's schools of thought within that. But I think there is this ongoing thread in studies that has taken that a third position that isn't about, yeah, like, what is the racial identity of blackness in the Americas? Like, what is the experience of blackness? But really trying to, I think, like, for instance, like Du Bois, I think, you know, though he's kind of popularly taken up in this like very broad based way, it's like, oh, double consciousness, and like, what does it feel like to be black? Like, he's actually, like, a lot of his writing, as we know, is like about the relationship between like blackness, black subjects, and like, you know, the history of labor, you know. So it's kind of really trying to find, like, over the course of like 200 or 300 years, I think there's been a body of work in Black studies that's like workshop this position. And I guess that's also what that essay was sort of about, was like, I think the other thing that's important is just that the argument for me wasn't a critique of accelerationism as, you know, not doing justice to incorporating, like, not in a sort of humanistic, you know, you must include black people in your analysis kind of way, but it was really a broader argument about the fact that any radical theory of the subject along this accelerationist sort of vector that wants to think about inhumanity would just have an easier time if it sort of looked to Black studies and how it's theorized the subject. And then kind of like to sort of synthesize, yeah, the work there and then the work in the sort of accelerationist, like, historical library, we could say. It's forming a separate third, as you're saying, forming a separate third position that not only can adequately think about the role of Blackness in the Western world and in terms of accelerationism, but also is it sort of scalable, flexible structure that can incorporate a broader theory of the subject and be useful to everyone who's looking for a way out.
The term has already come up in discussions both by, you know, by Craig and yourself. I was wondering if you could say a little bit about how we should understand primitive accumulation and white supremacy in the development of racial capitalism. Because there's a discussion of this a little bit in your paper. You cite, I don't know how to pronounce it, I'm afraid, is it ICO or ECO Day? If we consider primitive accumulation as a persistent structure rather than event, both Afro-pessimism and settler colonial studies destabilize normative conceptions of capitalism through conceptual displacements of the proletariat. And I guess I was wondering, you know, if, you know, Marxists would say, you know, primitive accumulation is both a sort of foundational event for the development of capitalism, but also this ongoing process. I guess maybe just, you know, how does this relate to our understanding of, in particular, you know, slavery and racism, you know, in your understanding of how this relates to capitalism, I suppose, and its development.
I mean, I guess, like, I think to me, maybe this is like sideways answer in it, but I think this sort of, it sounds like what you're talking about is sort of like, sort of a question of timelines in a way, or sort of the, you know, sort of like in this quote where she's like, the, if we consider primitive accumulation as a persistent structure rather than event, both Afro-pessimism and settler colonial studies destabilize normative conceptions of capitalism through the conceptual displacements of the proletariat. I think, like, I guess this kind of goes back to, maybe this is really just speculation, kind of like as I'm thinking as I'm talking, but again, it goes back to maybe the sort of what I was saying about the position of Blackness kind of remaining the same, and then capital kind of like continuing to morph and structure itself in different ways around that. And so I'm kind of picturing like a rock and a stream a little bit. But I think that, like, with that, so the persistence of that structure is like, I think that that dispossession of the slave's body, like, rather than sort of an evolving like situation of a, yeah, like new like Black proletariat or something, it's a persistent process that's required in order for like the sort of shifting alienations of a proletariat or of like a labor force to, it's like a subterranean layer or something of that process. So like, I think like, and I think that in my view, I mean, I think like with including this quote, I remember actually very vividly when writing this, like, they're like, you really should include this like quote about primitive accumulation. And I was like, okay, like, I feel like it's like, for me, like, kind of maybe not actually that central to the argument, because I don't think that like the stuff that like theory of labor that, you know, Marx and all of his like, you know, descendants or whatever offer is necessarily wrong. It's like there's the subterranean layer of it that has to be thought before we think about how those things operate or something.
You know, would you say that then, so is the idea something like that, you know, Marxists will sort of concentrate on the sort of proletarianization of, you know, labor and so on. Mm-hmm. And you're sort of, it sounds like what you're arguing is that this kind of racial and white supremacist element is in some sense more basic than, more primary rather than sort of a proletariat. It's really, yeah, really looking at, you know, slavery in particular and the history of that.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And I think like it's, I mean, in Cedric Robinson's Black Marxism, for instance, I think he sort of has a chapter where he sort of talks about the, you know, because obviously there's also this, you know, this ongoing problem, you know, where people will be like, well, you know, slavery didn't begin with the transatlantic slave trade. And it's like, yes, that's absolutely the case. And there were like many different forms of slavery prior to that. But the really important thing that happens is sort of the making slavery and the position of the slave an ontological position in that moment rather than, right, you know, just a relation of production. And so there's a section in that book where he's talking about like, the Irish in Europe and sort of the way that, like, you know, their labor power was used, and then with the advent of the transatlantic slave trade, kind of the displacement of the Irish then into a proletariat rather than like a sort of like slave subjectivity. And so, like, in this way, it's almost like this kind of, you know, like this weird ladder where it's like, okay, like, put, you know, we've found this thing to sort of place, like, the Black subject can be placed at the bottom rung of the ladder, or sort of, or as the membrane of this idea of the human such that then there can be a proletariat that then has that, you know, the relationship to labor that we classically understand as, alienation, et
cetera. I just wanted to sort of build up some of the points, even to possibly even answer some of one of Craig's original questions about the relationship to contemporary capitalism and blackness. Mm-hmm. How I sort of read your essay, and particularly your use of Wilderson, is the constitution of the black subject as a subject that is capitalized upon, but can never really capitalizing upon itself, because there's, we think of the proletarian as exchanging labor for wages. The direction isn't the direction of exchange in the ontological constitution of blackness. It's only ever one way. You know, the Nick Landon people, you know, of his ilk think that capital is this feedback loop that just gets exchanging with itself all the time. But in this essay, you show very well that historically, no, there needs to be this one way that starts off this excess of potential energy, which starts the whole process going. And I kind of see this as still, you know, obviously still happening today when I think about the notion of, you know, how long a black dollar stays in the black community. If you look at 17 days, a white stays in the white community 6 hours. If I'm looking at the Black Star Project's stats, and it seems that capital to this day relies on a lack of exchange, a pure one-directional extraction of from the black subject. And I'm wondering if the project of a black accelerationism opens up this question of what is to be accelerated. Is there meant to be a kind of a withholding of this one-way motion of exchange of the black body, or is there an accelerated potential to go through capitalism through actually keeping sort of the black capital? Is there kind of like a sort of like, and I guess Killer Mike has this, you know, project of keeping the black dollar in the black community, and I was wondering if there's a sort of accelerationist model there of accelerating through capital by turning away the extractive pre-proletarianizing constitution of blackness upon itself to be the inheritor of this new world.
Yeah, no, totally. I mean, I think that, yeah, that's kind of something that I've been really thinking a lot about lately. And a friend and I have been like working on some projects, like trying to think this through a bit. And I think to me, I think the portion of, well, I mean, yeah, I think there's been like a number of kind of real world examples in the last few years that have kind of laid bare. Yeah, that's sort of these, like, I think in the art world, for instance, there was the whole thing with the Dana Schutz Emmett Till painting, which I think I mentioned in the essay, where, like, you know, it's kind of this, like, and this is kind of more about like a symbolic economy, I guess, or something, but it does have its obviously actual material element, being that the painting is, you know, an object for exchange. But yeah, this sort of thing where, like, you know, yeah, not being able to lay claim to, in this case, an image, and then kind of, you know, its circulation. And I think that something that I guess I've been thinking about, I mean, with the Killer Mike thing, I think that, like, that to me, like, keeping money in buck, I mean, I don't know. I mean, practically speaking, like, seems really good, but on this sort of conceptual level, I don't view it as in line with at least my thinking around a sort of like the sort of accelerationist bent. I think that to me, the key about the sort of black accelerationism thing, or one of the keys, is again the sort of inhuman subjectivity thing, and not solely the commodity element of it, but also the sort of instability between individual and collective in the sort of black subjectivity. And so I don't even know how much I really go into that in this particular text, but I've written about it a fair amount elsewhere. This idea that, you know, and again, thinking about how in a lot of, you know, philosophy and political writing, you know, let's say at least in the latter half of the 20th century into the 21st century, amongst like American and European like white theorists and philosophers, there's been this like desire for some sort of, you know, group subjectivity or group consciousness, like, you know, like the multitude, the, you know, whatever. So kind of thinking, I've also done a lot of thinking about how blackness kind of fills that role, or kind of like is somewhere in that territory. And I think that that's actually the thing that was interesting to me in terms of an actual accelerationist project with relationship to blackness, that like if one black individual can't really maintain a proper relationship to, you know, or kind of gird against that extraction of, you know, one-way extraction of their labor, like, is there a possibility for a collective body to find a way to lay claim to that? So, like, I don't know, my friend and I have been talking about kind of like, in terms of like the circulation of cultural objects, like is there a way to figure something that's more like collective intellectual property or something where it's like, okay, like there, and this is like a whole other, this is like way like off topic kind of, but anyway, I was thinking about like group consciousness, groups, and sort of like, I guess like recently I've been reading a lot more about like communization theory and stuff and kind of like thinking about those things alongside Black studies. But I think that like, I don't know. I mean, I think it's hard because there's like the Killer Mike thing, for instance, seems like it ultimately in practice becomes a practical, but like quite liberal, you know, chill, good thing.
Highly recuperated.
Yeah, but it doesn't really ask questions about the larger structure of like, I don't know, it doesn't take on the economy at like scale or something, you know, it's not questioning like the very nature of exchange in that way. But I don't know, there was this David Marriott essay in Eflux, like maybe also in 2017, called like On Bling, I think. And in it, like, and he's of course sort of affiliated with Afro-pessimist thinking, but in it he talked about the economics of bling, like with rappers, and how, you know, people criticize rappers for, you know, like, oh, you're just like sinking money into these objects, you know, kind of just like the sort of like wasteful, you know, economy of like rap extravagance or whatever. But he makes this argument in this essay about like it being a really interesting and like a really particular, and in some ways, like he doesn't go so far as to say it's anti-capitalist, but he's like, there's something weird about the relation to capital that the concept of bling like exemplifies. Like it is sinking capital into these objects that then, you know, kind of just sit there and maybe can be, you know, hawked eventually for, you know, whatever, but it's a one-way relationship to the economy, I guess. And it's like, it's not like a lot of like, and he sort of like talks about how in rap, like a lot of the way that like rappers are engaging with like all this money they're making is not to like invest it, not to like, you know, start participating. It's like kind of just, it becomes like dead capital, which I think is like interesting. I don't know. Like, I think that that's like, it's not great in terms of like a functionally, like a healthy functional relationship to a larger economy that then is going to benefit you in the long run. But it is like a interesting other way of engaging that, yeah, is like negative and can be positive or something.
That mention of bling and jewels is really fascinating because I think a lot of us on the podcast are big fans of Georges Bataille, who tries to sort of reorient sort of the idea of capitalism around this idea of like pure expenditure, and then the idea of revolution itself as a kind of pure expenditure. And maybe in a sense what you're sort of demonstrating when you commit yourself to certain expenditures on artifacts like jewels is also sort of a display of sort of one's sovereignty over the sort of the potential energy that you've accumulated. And I think, yeah, maybe the idea of reclaiming the potential energy rather than simply being to an extent, yeah, a capitalist realist in the Killer Mike project. I think, yeah, this idea of reclaiming energy is potentially quite an explosive notion, definitely.
The Bataille connection is like interesting, and I think, I mean, I'm a fan, very much enjoy Bataille, and I think like that notion of the accursed chair, like in Achillean Mbembe's Critique of Black Reason, which I was reading earlier in quarantine, have been like slowly slogging through because it's like a lot of information, but in that he talks a lot about the accursed chair and like blackness, and he kind of like connects blackness to the accursed chair and like uses Bataille, which I think is really interesting. And I think there's a lot actually there to parse through, and that's another sort of pet project of mine, kind of has been like reading across Bataille and a lot of Black studies, and even the sort of, I don't know if you've read this book. It's like this Rosalind Krauss and Yves Landbois book called Formlessness, A User's Guide. And they talk about Bataille and like the abject and how it appears in a lot of art practices and sort of like trying to work through that on an aesthetic level. And there's not a lot of Black art that's in there, but the way what they're talking about when they're like narrating these art objects, there is a lot of like Black art that actually exemplifies that sort of, that sits in that territory that might be considered the object in that way.
I want to go back into accelerationism a bit vis-a-vis Black accelerationism. Mm-hmm. It's interesting because we started off the discussion talking about the figure of Blackness and primitive accumulation, which established the ontology of Blackness with real historical Black bodies. But the way that you have cast mm-hmm. the figure of Blackness, it doesn't necessarily instantiate cultural characteristics and maybe even perhaps other characteristics that we might associate with Blackness. And I'm wondering if what I'm about to say about Marx and Marxism might help us dig through that a little bit. I have a question here. It says, what role do you think that Marx or Marxism plays in accelerationism vis-a-vis Black accelerationism? Here I'm thinking about Marx's fragment on machines and the notion of the development of fixed capital as an objective entity, one, moreover, that is or becomes inhuman. In any case, it seems that at either end of the extractive program of capital, inhuman subjects exist. At the first pole, we find the dehumanized victims of racial capital, as you point out in notes. And at the opposing pole, we have the real abstraction produced by capital, which dispossesses the human qua human in the creation of the inhuman. In my meditation on this yesterday evening, I was like, wow, that's really interesting. And so the question that just goes with that sort of mini essay I dropped on you, what do you think the figure of Blackness plays in the evolution of capital as I've described it there, from historical Black bodies, the deaths of those bodies, the extraction of those bodies, evolving into this notion of inhuman, fixed, seemingly objective capital in the form of machines, in the form of a post-humanism? Is there a connection there?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think that the sort of, yeah, this one is one that I think for, yeah, has been something that, like, negotiating has been difficult, I think, in the process of writing this and since, because, like, one, with regard to the post-humanism thing, like, I definitely don't consider myself a post-humanist, but I've, like, you know, done a lot of reading and thinking in that space also because I, like, do a lot of work with, like, media theory stuff through my job at Rhizome, and so that's, like, always been part of it. But I think there's an interesting, there's a connection there, and I think that it's a difficult one. I guess when I think about how it's difficult, I think about sort of the timeline of it all, I guess, because I think it is, it basically is, like, there is this, like, massive connection to post-humanism, yes. Like, I think people like Alex Wahelier and, like, a few other writers have, like, in Black Studies have really teased that out. And I think there's also such a, like, you know, specifically thinking about machines and, you know, like, machines as objects, machines as, you know, actors, like, whatever. There's this thread of a recognition of, like, a resonance between the Black body and machine, you know, sort of, I mean, obviously in the sort of history of white supremacy, this, like, racist, you know, sort of, like, treatment of the Black body as machinic, you know, and using it, at, you know, like, through slavery, like, you know, treating Black people as, yeah, machines to produce or whatever. But I think then, like, because of these resonances, there's kind of, like, this post-humanism, but also it's, like, it's not post, you know what I mean? It's like anti-humanism, I suppose.
Yeah, I mean, clearly the figure of Blackness is not merely an empty abstraction. It's underpinned by historically oppressed Black bodies. And it's not something that just exists in the past. We look at communities today that are predominantly Black and still experience many of the negative effects of capitalism, economic immiseration, redlining, selective law enforcement, and what have you. But at the same time, mm-hmm. this other sort of principle is at work alongside. And I'm trying to use Deleuze and Guattari as a way to think about it, because it seems like the figure of Blackness operates as a kind of relay that communicates with real Black mm-hmm. bodies, but it has this it's an operator that has other functions that operates maybe on bodies that don't necessarily instantiate Black characteristics all the time or ever. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, yeah. There's definitely a kind of ontological fuzziness there that we have to contend with in theorizing this. The question is, what terms do we use to get there?
Well, Fred Moten has a really, yeah, I mean, I totally agree. And yeah, it's actually funny because before you sent like the questions, like, the Deleuze, like, becoming Black thing has been, like, I was rereading that intro to schizoanalysis section of Anti-Oedipus and, like, caught that weird, there's that weird line where he's like, one must find a line of fight, even if it means becoming Black, like John Black. I'm like, what is, like, yeah. This is crazy. Like, it's a weird moment. And, like, I've been, like, kind of meditating on that. Cause I mean, we can come back to that. I think it's like a really,
you know, I'm really interested in theories of race, but, you know, being a white man, it's hard to get a foothold in the debate, right? That's just the way that the terrain is. But, I mean, Deleuze and Guattari do present a sort of interesting alternative to what we see in critical race theory today, which is the opening up of Blackness and some of its elements to become communicating elements with things that are not ordinarily associated with being Black. And when you look at their work, it's a major shift in the problematic of race in a way that would be possibly deemed problematic by people who are studying race today.
Right. Well, so what I was going to say about the, I think it's interesting. So Fred Moten in, I think it's in Poetics of the Undercommons, a little pamphlet that I don't know if it might be like PDF somewhere, but he kind of like, I mean, a lot of his work kind of, you know, it sort of works on this sort of like, you know, he's in this space where he's like, okay, there's this thing, Blackness, there's us, Black people, how are we connecting these things? Like, you know, he's talking about how Blackness operates. And in this piece directly, he's like, Blackness is basically this like material and conceptual, which, you know, this is like another issue, but material and conceptual force in the universe and like in the world that, you know, has like many different forms, many different names, but has been stewarded by Black people, whether we want to steward it or not. So it's kind of like, I think he phrases it as like, we've been entrusted to like, kind of like hold on to it, you know, in our time on this planet or something, which I think is a really poetic and really, really apt like way of describing it. Cause it's like, yeah, there's this thing, you know, and it's not an object, but it's like a you know, some sort of, yeah, force, I think is the best way to describe it. That sometimes, and the way that I think about it, it's like Blackness is this thing that like sticks to stuff, kind of. It's like it, and it can, and there are people who it sticks to very, you know, like intensely because we're marked Black in the world, but then there's like, it can find its way onto and into, you know, other zones, and or people can stumble into it and, you know, kind of like, I guess, yeah, it has a sort of like viral quality, I suppose.
And it seems like the function and the value of it can shift depending on the context. I mean, I think about, for example, the value and status of Black celebrities and athletes, where the Blackness becomes commodifiable, but it could be 10 minutes after the moment of its valorization that Blackness becomes, once again, that dehumanized quality, you know, just them getting in their car, getting on the freeway, and then something happens, right?
Right. Also, to go back to the post-humanism thing, and I think what it goes with this too, is I think that one of the things that I would push for in terms of like this, just a specificity of language, is like inhuman over dehumanized. I think it's like an important distinction, because I think there's a lot of conversation about like dehumanization, which I think on a sort of maybe let's say like political or and phenomenological level, like is the experience that of, you know what I mean, like that sort of encounter of like, oh, like the sort of like Fanonian sort of like, you know, moment when the child identifies him as a Black man and he's like, oh, I'm like fixed in this body, like that is this dehumanizing encounter, but the actuality of it is an inhuman subjectivity. And I think this, you know, using Sylvia Winter is really useful here. Like, she's written a lot on this, and there's this short essay, No Humans Involved, where she's written, you know, on sort of like genres of man and the process of the human as a concept being workshopped throughout modernity. And in this No Humans Involved essay, she connects it to exactly what you're talking about, sort of like policing, and talks about the LAPD using this acronym NHI, No Humans Involved, when they're phoning in encounters that are like when like they're like are going to arrest like a group of Black men, which is it's like this really weird, it's a really interesting text. And it's like, and she's writing around the time of the LA riots in the 90s, and like, which is also, yeah, but this No Humans Involved thing I think is really important, because it's basically like, to me, the crucial part of the whole Black accelerationist thing, and also the crucial part of a lot of Afro-pessimist writing, is that it's not a denigration of one's humanity or a being pushed outside of. It's really like we're starting from the outside, and the Blackness is the outside and has this dialogue and is locked into some sort of like, you know, dialectical relationship with the human, but it's not a process of like being like turned in. And I think it also saves the comics. I think the other issue is that conversations around white supremacy, racism, Blackness become, you know, very humanistic very quickly, where, you know, because obviously we're talking about situation where people are being denied rights, being denied, like legal rights, but then also kind of conceptual rights and humanitarian rights, or whatever. And so it's very easy to, I think, when using dehumanizing or, you know, that kind of language, it becomes easier to subsume it into an identity politics conversation, or a, like, you know, vote Joe Biden, like he might make the cops stop, you know, that kind of thing, rather than this sort of like a larger theory of blackness kind of thing.
But you brought up Fred Moten earlier, and I've been having a little look, trying to slowly read through The Undercommons recently, actually. And so this is a slightly vague question, but do you see some overlap between your own work and the work that we find in, you know, both Fred Moten and his work with Stefano Harney in The Undercommons? Is there connections there, or is this a slightly different sort of project, I suppose?
I think there are connections. It's been a while since I actually read The Undercommons, and I think of Moten's work, it's not the one that I think has been for a lot of this stuff, but I do think, if I remember correctly, I think, is it in there that there's a fair amount of stuff around like debt, right? And like kind of like I think that becomes really useful, and I think is, you know, I think more recently, because I think I've been thinking more about the economic dimension of this whole black accelerationism thing of late, and I think that like the debt stuff in there probably is like, it's like very, you know, useful. And I think also, I mean, I think the project, the fact that I think also, you know, they're writing together and they've taken on this project. And to my understanding also that The Undercommons as a concept is not, again, it's like something that's able to incorporate more than just blackness, even though there's a certain centrality of blackness to some of the arguments around it. But it's like, I think it's really important. And I know a lot of people, there are people who vehemently would disagree, but I think it's really important to begin to try to like devise these theories that are about blackness for itself, but are really also, you know, that almost, again, maybe this is part of the sort of meta layer, like that exact sort of one-way extraction problem or something. Like, I'm really okay with, on a theoretical level, like giving like myself over to theorizing blackness for an extractive use value on a larger scale when it comes to like thinking about, yeah, like that this is this problem. I think it's like, I'm not like, oh no, but we have to only talk about how this can benefit black people. It's like,
yeah, because it seems like they're, in a certain sense, that the Undercommons, and again, I can't claim to have read the entire book yet, I'm afraid, but it seems like they're also trying to struggle with this question of subjectivity on a sort of almost collective scale, right? How do we understand this space relative to capitalism, to capital, in a way which sort of does justice to the, in one sense, the centrality of a black experience there, but also keeps it open to the variety of experiences that they think are important. Mm-hmm. So that's one connection I would make with your work and what they're doing, sort of this concern with the subjectivity in a certain way. Of this agent relative to capital, I suppose.
Definitely, I agree. And I think that's something that, like, I think, you know, for instance, I think I like Moten's work and I find it useful precisely for that reason. Again, going back to that Poetics of the Undercommons thing, where he's really, you know, describing that movement of blackness and how it is this, you know, I think he also terms it this other no thing, which I think is really interesting. And I think that's another dimension of this that I've been really interested in, is sort of this, like, recently I've been talking to people about how, if we don't call this black accelerationism, can it just sit under like black nihilism, right? Yeah. Or something, which like Warren, you know, writes about and like talks about how the fear of blackness and anti-blackness globally masks a fear of like nothingness, and that blackness has come to represent the nothingness that, you know, a world like ours can't bear to imagine is the operative force around us. But with Moten, I think that openness that he gives the project is really useful. And I think that, as much as I think like Wilderson's analysis and his structural approach is incredibly central to how I think, he also has this sort of, you know, he has this caveat where he's always saying that the situation of blackness is specific to itself, and that you can't really compute the, you know, tools of analysis in a way that, like, it's not like that the grammar of violence around blackness, around anti-blackness is not a grammar that can be connected to or applied to other, you know, historical and like bodily situations for other groups. So, which I disagree with. I think there is increasingly, you know, as we're talking about, there are these parallels and like that basic experience of dispossession is becoming the main operative experience of like most individuals on Earth.
Okay, Will, did you want to come in with a question now?
Yeah, I do have a question because the mention of Willerson and Fanon, it seems that in like Marxian analysis, like proper, and in responses to it, and what I found particularly interesting is your essay in Efflux sort of presupposes that blackness from the onset in Capital is not something that like it's something that's perpetually dehumanized, which is what we sort of get in more liberal analyses of Capital and race, where it's like it's this entity that finds particular bodies that become dehumanized, but like the very nature of like enslaved black bodies as fixed capital presupposes the inhuman nature, which I think is fascinating, because what it does to Marxian analysis is an analysis that already has like racialized terms, right? Like in Wretched of the Earth, there's an extensive discussion about the lumpen proletariat as like a fundamentally racialized entity, where at the same time both like black bodies are in this analysis of Capital both like under-theorized as historically like fixed capital, right, and the implications that come with that. But then at the other end of it, you see this sort of notion of like the redundant populace and these sort of like hyper-racialized notions of like crime. And I'm wondering, you know, with Willerson and with Fanon, how, in a sense, because both this inhuman nature that we get out of like accelerationist literature from like, I mean, both Land and Williams and even like Fisher, of this like sort of the outside, right? That the outside is in fact the thing that is already sort of the line of flight per se, that is not meant to sort of liberate maybe this notion of the human, but in fact it is its own sort of path that we're out of control of. But then there's another interpretation of the outside, right, which is sort of this subalternity, or this sort of criminality, these to take the Deleuzean term, sort of these small war machines that get appropriated by the state, right? Like black bodies are overwhelmingly represented in like military conflicts like Vietnam and so on. But then, you know, you find sort of, so I'm wondering, like, how do you square these issues where in one sense there's this tendency under Capital to treat black bodies as both like something that's always at the disposal of Capital, but then always must be like perpetually treated as like a threat?
I mean, yeah, I think that's like the core of it all, right? I think that's the thing that's the thing that I think prompted the essay overall, right? It's like, that's why in this, like, if we're talking accelerated, that paired with the whole like, you know, sort of human commodity thing is the whole reason that like it looks like there's actually something that could be very useful about blackness in this sort of accelerationist politics, because it's like, okay, if it's such a threat and is so intimately involved, that's like a very interesting and kind of confusing corner to sit in. And I think like it's kind of there's a point in which also I think I was trying to use a lot of like, or I wasn't trying, I was using a lot of like La Ruelle to kind of like also think through this, because I think like that, you know, just the even really, really like simple way that, you know, he's militating against like binaristic thought and stuff is kind of really helpful for me, at least to sort of, yeah, like start to square these things. But on a practical level, I think it is the thing that is both like difficult to me in that, like, for instance, yeah, okay, so it's like, you know, let's say going back to like music and pop culture, right? Like, let's say like the sort of criminality thing, like, like history of rap in the last like 30 years. It's like, oh, like, yeah, like this like sort of fetishization of the outside, of criminality, and like, you know, some sort of authenticity, you know, in earlier eras, and like, you know, the like gangster, like, et cetera. And then of course that becomes like, you know, entirely recuperated into the, you know, capitalist structure as like an, you know, image and as a position. But still then on a like functional level, so it's like it's totally recuperated, but then also there is the kind of constant policing and
Lil Wayne makes money for like primarily like white music labels, but then still gets like random weapons charges and so
there's kind of this like weird thing where like nothing tracks with itself kind of in this like really weird way. But I think that like, and so, but then, so with that, and there's this article, in Mask magazine a few years ago, right before Trump was elected. But basically it's about sort of like the question of black radicalism and this question of like black celebrity and like the culture sphere and like the political, and sort of it was this moment when like, you know, like Beyonce had done like that Black Panthers like performance or whatever at the Super Bowl, and like there was kind of this weird infusion of like this image of like black radicalism in black popular culture, which always has happened in various ways, but it felt like it's a really concentrated moment. And this article was by this guy Tyler Reinhardt, and it was basically sort of asking like, is it possible that the like history of the black radicalism and like what happened like let's say in the 70s, like did those ideals get sort of relocated into a black like pop cultural sphere? So like, and especially because a lot of the people who were involved in black popular culture, you know, even have like family members who were like, you know, involved in some of those like politics, or, you know, like there's a sort of weird handing down of these things. But at the same time, you can't really ignore the fact that like Jay-Z and Beyonce are like incredible, you know, have so much money and like, you know, are donating some here and there, but they're still like, you know, and they're still willing to participate in the establishment. So there's this like weird paradox. And I guess the article really arose this question of like, you know, if we take a sort of maybe this isn't what the article is saying, but the question that I have had recently is like, at what point, you know, does an argument around like bling or like Killer Mike saying whatever, like at what point are we making high-level conceptual arguments that are kind of just excuses for continuing to participate in a structure? Mm-hmm. Or is there something actually exceptional about blackness, or you know, how black people are forced to move and engage with these economies that does make it different? Like, you know, there, and I don't know, and I don't think there's one way or the other, but I think that that's, so I guess one of the things that thing, you know, that contradiction that you're talking about makes it really difficult to practically analyze any sort of action, you know, and I mean, I think with the George Floyd stuff, this was like a huge, I mean, that was really confusing.
That was actually my next question too. I wanted to get to that and to see to what extent the whole George Floyd event brought to bear on your view of black accelerationism, or the way that you view black accelerationism now has changed in view of that event. And maybe this is a good time to bring back in the notion of becoming black, because this is where I thought of Deleuze and Guattari, because it was in the moment where we saw the most salient dehumanizing image of a black body in the most stark terms mm-hmm. possible. I mean, everybody was sitting at home too because of the pandemic. It was right mm-hmm. there in front of our faces. And that event had the ability to mobilize, I mean, not only black people, but basically the entirety of the left of the United States to take to the streets. And to me, when I hear the term becoming black, and when I consider it in the context of the way that Deleuze and Guattari meant that term, that to me seems close, or it seems to approximate what it is they're talking about, where no matter what racial characteristics you instantiate, our bearing witness to the dehumanization of a black body as a collective, we come to occupy that subordinate position together to rupture the structures that oppress. And I mean, this happened in very real terms, and it's continuing to happen in places like Portland and elsewhere. And so I'm curious if you have changed or altered your view on the basis of that event.
I mean, it really, I thought it's like, it was really weird. Cause I think, not to be like self-aggrandizing in any way, but I mean, I think that in that piece, I don't know if it was the very last line, but I was like, there's that, you know, I think I did a play on, like if there's like, if Kamat claims there can be revolution that is not for the human, a statement that isn't retroactively claimed by accelerationists, then this revolution is for the black. Like that was the way that I ended the piece. And, you know, in the height of the George Floyd stuff, I was like, oh, whoa, like that is what's happening. Like, right. It was kind of like, it felt like, you know, you know, and then it got complicated. It was complicated, and it, you know, we, the whether or not it's a revolution is another question, you know?
Right.
I think that it didn't so much change my feelings on things. It confirmed, it kind of closed out that portion of the project in a way for me, right? It was like, okay, I made this offering, this speculative offering, and then kind of watched stuff catch up to it a little bit, or it seemed like some of the stuff was being enacted, and it was like, oh yeah, like, you know, because the way, just the fact that this George Floyd stuff was happening with this, you know, intersecting with all the COVID stuff and all, you know, the economic distress, and, you know, which I think, you know, just as much as people were inspired to go out into the streets because of how like fucked up that video was, and like the fact that cops were still killing Black people, also people were just like ready to, you know, riot, because it was like everyone was like stuck inside, a lot of people have no money, like nothing to do, so it was kind of like, it just, I think it was that really interesting cross-section, which to me is the cross-section that whole debate that, you know, between Fisher and Williams that I like use in that essay is about, like, okay, like if the economic structure is completely failing and collapsing, which, as you know, that the conversation was right after like 2008 and the financial crisis, then it's like, if everything's just up beyond belief, like, and then also, you know, we're watching this like racialized violence happen, like understanding that these things are impossible to separate to the degree that the only way through them would be to like, and then I think also this is where maybe the conceptual layer of like, you know, let's say the conceptual figuration of Blackness and the material of Blackness comes into play, right? Where it's also like, yes, going out there and being, I think on a political level to me, it's like in this country, a left movement that takes Blackness as its central concern or conceptual, you know, generator in some way is the strongest you can have it. Because historically, all the things that we're worried about, like, you know, alienation, the dispossession, whatever, like that stuff has been upheld by the position of Blackness in the US, the way that Black people have been subjugated. It's all wrapped up in it. So I think that that's like politically the most viable thing, but then also on a conceptual level with the Becoming Black thing, all of the things that Blackness like symbolizes or the things that it uses and the way that it moves and all that stuff also is like one's best shot, in my view, at like having a sort of like, even thinking about mass movements, again, that sort of collective consciousness or group consciousness in some way, and relationship to like things like communization, etc., like tapping into that stuff about Blackness, it makes you, you know, probably one of the, you can become a better a better leftist or a better rioter, a better, you know, all these things, like I think so. I know that's kind of a woo answer, but I think...
No, that's exactly where I'm at with it too. It's almost as if the stars aligned and made the perfect constellation of Blackness, and materially, conceptually, and not only that, just the mounting frustrations that we've all experienced in our system under the figure of Blackness just going, you know, 100%. And even though, as you're saying, it's not a revolution, it showed us how that circuit works.
Right, exactly. And I think that it was... And it also showed us the things that we have to really ask questions about around it too, right? It's like, okay, it showed us like, okay, this is kind of hitting, you know, people are like out here, whatever. Then also I think, you know, there was the question of like, you know, the new questions that have arisen in the last 10 years because of like the internet or the way that, you know, culture moves, that we have to now confront with a really, really well-honed new set of tools, I think, like the stuff about just like, you know, the way that like Instagram and Twitter are for functioning in a sort of like hot take economy where everyone is like, here's my infographic about like, did you know that like Black people are in prison? Like, you know, and like all that stuff. Where it was like, this is good. Information sharing is really important, but also really watching like the attention economy accelerate to a degree where like it just like the like sort of ethical, the weird intersection of like some sort of like, I guess like, yeah, like woke identity politics stuff and like the attention economy where like, suddenly, I guess the dark side of that Becoming Black thing was like this sort of bad, some of the bad faith solidarity or kind of like weird, like stunt pulling kind of stuff. And then also the other thing that I think is incredibly concerning is, and you guys asked a question about this in the email, which I was really excited about, was sort of the absolute confusion between material and symbolic justice that kind of resulted. Where like, you know, Vanity Fair magazine having like Breonna Taylor on the cover, and it was like, what? Like, that's like really a weird, like, you know, that's not what we need right now. But also, yeah, there are people who like, for whom that's like really meaningful. And maybe on an, you know, emotional level, or like someone sees that, and for some reason, that's the thing that, you know, gets them to feel like, wow, this is really an issue. Like, I buy that that could be the case, but there was this like, and even also, you know, like suddenly like, deposing like a bunch of like white editors at various publications and installing new black editors, or like, you know, just like, I feel like all of a sudden it was like, there was so much attention being paid to like representation, I guess, in a lot of ways. And that I think is like really frightening, because it's like, there's really not a way to, it's really hard to parse through that and argue against it. But the other thing I was going to say, I just wanted to make a plug for
a great
text that I revisited during this, which is the Guy Debord's piece on the 1960s, like Watts riot. I didn't know that, but it's really amazing, because I think it's really sits at the center of all of this, where he's basically like, yeah, like, a lot of people are rioting because, like, this, that happened, but it's really that they're taking on the very notion, like, the symbolic and material relationships that they've been forced to have to capital, and, like, it's, like, a larger kind of, like, just, like, example, like, again, sort of, he's, like, this is an example for everyone. It's not, like, you know, oh, no, the black people are upset. It's, like, this is a very implicitly well thought through, like, anti-capitalist intervention, you know, kind of that kind of thing.
I know that Adam has another question. And by the way, I'm writing down all of the references that you mentioned, and I'm going to put them in the show notes for people who are listening. You know, I probably want to have you back for another episode sometime in the future, maybe next year, especially, and I will get to Adam's question here in a second. I'm glad that you hit on the notion of representation as opposed to, let's say, the anti-representationalism of Deleuze and Guattari. And it's interesting because, you know, as operating in academia, where there's often a big split between like philosophy and ethnic studies departments, it's interesting because they're working with folks like Deleuze and Guattari. And then it makes me wonder, like, how is that analysis not getting incorporated into analyzing the gestures, like the Vanity Fair thing and so forth? Like, it seems to me that there's two currents. There's a representational blackness and then an anti-representational blackness.
Are you suggesting that academics are selectively reading material?
I plead the fifth. I'm sorry. But anyway, do you want to say something about that before we get on to Adam?
Yeah, I think that, I mean, that's something that I, you know, in my work as, you know, as an artist and then a who writes about art and about film, is something that's, you know, major preoccupation for me. And I think that it does feel like there is the sort of like, yeah, I feel like there's kind of two camps, like, you know, people who are like, you know, there's like that refrain, like, representation matters, that you just see like in popular culture, but then also is like absolutely something that people are building entire academic and like critical frames around, which, like, to me is kind of ridiculous insofar as like, like, I mean, there's, you know, there's like a whole other, in some ways, yeah, a whole other like hole to go down, but sort of, you know, the failures of representation conceptually when it comes to blackness. And like, I'll just name drop a few. I think like Frank Wilderson's book, Red, White, and Black, which is about, cinema and blackness on screen, is a really great book on this, where basically he just talks about the ways in which, like, sort of, you know, like the circuitry of the cinematic apparatus, like, in the way that it functions, and we've understood it to function in terms of representation, does not really make sense in relation to blackness, and how also the discourse around blackness on screen over the course of cinematic history has functioned so heavily, or like relied so heavily on sort of like pedagogical like conversation around like just treating images of black people as though like, yeah, they're like these pedagogical objects of like, oh, like, you know, we don't want to put that stereotype on screen because like it's going to teach white America that we're XYZ, and like this, you know, weird like necessary but very strange fixation on representation, because like and something that I've written about and thought about a bit is like, why is that deemed so important in relation to blackness? And my argument around is kind of that there's like a really specific relationship between the image and reality that blackness represents, or not represents, but like relies on or is structured by. So like, that blackness, in order for it to exist at all had to, was kind of a media campaign, you know, like between like illustration and writing and, you know, narrativizing the concept of it. But then of course there's the anti-representational side of things. People are like, yeah, like don't, and even ethically speaking with, let's say, relationship to these police brutality videos, like don't show this, like don't, you know, whatever, kind of like completely militating against representation. And then I think also, and I probably fall somewhere closer, I mean, I think like I've used a lot of the work that happened in that space to think through this stuff, but I also think it's like, you can't really, it doesn't work when like, you know, you have to be a bot. You can walk around with like a veil, all, you know what I mean? It's like, or you could, but it's like, you know, we are all body images. So like the anti-representational line of thinking does begin to fail when you're thinking about like the body as an image, and you know, in like capitalism, or also particularly again with blackness being so related to media, but even also in sort of like Bergsonian sort of, you know, like I think it's like, anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I'm thinking about, you know, representation is connected to the black holes of Guattari's work. And there are moments in which certain lines of flight are emitted from those black holes. And representation can be used in ways that can bring like a rupture to the greater edifice of representation. But I don't want to edge Adam out. Adam, you have another question.
I guess what I was sort of been thinking about for all this is the idea of representation without exchange, because I think of, you know, the image of the burning police station and the idea that was, you know, the protesters, there wasn't the notion of exchange with the powers that be with the police. There wasn't an entry into an economics of liberal democracy. It was unconditional. It was an unconditional expenditure, reducing these oppressive structures into waste. And I think this image and this figure of expenditure that's grounded in the conception that you draw from Mulderson on the one-directional nature of the ontology of the black body is quite important here in terms of expenditure. But one of the most important things I think about this essay on black accelerationism is that it entirely reorients what the typical, lack of better term, memes of accelerationism, which is, you know, as Land puts it, you know, the subject arise from the future. There's always this something to come, be it some, you know, Terminator, gargantuan undulating god AI or something of the sort. And really this thing has always already been here with us, and it has an insurgent potential because of its inherent detachment from the capitalist logic of exchange, both on the material and the symbolic level. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to ask, where do you think there is a potential for, to use the communizer term, the coming insurrection, the coming insurgency against symbolic, where exchange is no longer represented, rather the revolutionary potentials of expenditure, the bling of the burning of the burning police station, to use David Marriott's term?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think like to me, I mean, yeah, this is the thing with the George Floyd stuff that was like the heartbreaking part of it was like watching, yeah, that like insane, like sick, like complete, yeah, expenditure complete, you know, like, we exited the hyperloop kind, you know, and kind of like was like, oh shit, like, okay, now we're really talking. And then it kind of was, you know, it quickly recuperated and brought back into this loop of like liberal politics and that kind of discourse. I think to me, sort of like, not quite the most direct answer, but to me, I think the thing that feels like the most promising in relationship to that, like coming insurrection and stuff, is like the reinvigoration of like, again, it's like group consciousness, but not on the scale of like, oh, like we all think that, you know, the police are racist, but like, kind of having to return to maybe almost as a negative externality of it, like for me, let's say I can speak for myself, like as a negative externality of like that whole thing. I was like, I can't really go on the internet in the way that I was before, because I'll just get caught up in this, like, you know, and like was watching everything and then having to read all the bad takes. And then like now, even in the aftermath, it's like still just like, you know, completely like dark sided. Like, I just can't deal with like Twitter too, whatever.
I hate it too.
Treated into my existing networks of people and people who I've like been thinking alongside for years, or like new friends who suddenly I'm like, oh, you know, we're like we're, you know, intersecting at like this point, let's think about that together. Not that I'm just only like spending my time in reading groups and like whatever, but, you know, I do spend a lot of my time with friends who are really interested in like, you know, working on these problems and things. So I think that's been really great. I think like basically the like unsustainability of the sort of scale of life that we were operating at in certain ways, in terms of like, and even like the idea of like with going to protest or whatever, like that you kind of really, you know, it's like, oh, who can I go with? Like, who cares about this in a way that I care about it? So I know that like, if I want to go this far, this person's going with me, or I, or this, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, if I want to go, like, be part of burning down the police station, are the friends I'm going with, like, they, do they understand what that means? And like, why we would do that? And like, kind of having to really reorient yourself, sort of socially and politically in that way.
So, an affinity group of expenditure.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think also for me, different kinds of like, you know, figurings of that expenditure. But I think it seems like suddenly a lot of people, and maybe it's just in my sort of, you know, social world, but like suddenly became much more okay with doing things for the just simply because they desire it and because, you know, they want to see it exist. Like even this like magazine project I've been working on with a friend, like there's no money attached to it. We just kind of were like, we really want to like, we're tired of the publishing we're seeing, like, let's just do this thing. And like, we might not be able to pay the writers really, we're not really sure, but like, we just need to like make something new. And I think that just kind of slipping little parts of life, you know, back out of that sort of feedback loop of capital has been something that I feel like I've seen. But I don't know. I mean, I think with regard to like blackness and let's say with like race and then the larger, you know, whatever kind of revolution or whatever, I think it feels to me like everything kind of got like, you know, it was like kind of, we had to like respawn or something. Mm. And now it's like everyone kind of building from the ground up and kind of like, oh, okay, like, how do I care about this thing? Like, what do I don't know, or at least people I know who have already been like 1 foot outside of the like, you know, media sphere. I don't know. But it's a bit, I do think of the whole, but the whole, also over the summer kind of was a bit depressing for me, I think, in the end. Like, it didn't pan out, you know. And I did this interview with Frank Wilderson, like, around the time, maybe like June or something. And he was like, yeah, it's cool, but like, this is just going to result in like, it's just going to be brought back into, he's like, I'm not hopeful that it's going to mean like, oh, we've exited, you know, the situation that we've been in progressively for the last 200 years. He's like, this will snap back and be recuperated. And like, you know, the liberal left will start saying X, Y, Z, and then it's just not going to be. And then it's also going to be about policy and about, you know, police and about like, you know, it's not going to be about blackness. It's going to be, you know, just kind of, which is okay in certain ways, but it's also.
Aria, it's been awesome having you on this episode. I really like the way that things turned out. You talked about your magazine. I hope that you have some more to say either about that or other things that you're working on as a way to end.
Oh, yeah. So the magazine is called November Magazine. It's www.novembermag.com. And at the moment, it's like, it's just kind of interviews with like artists and thinkers, like across like architecture, critical theory, philosophy, and art. And in the spring, we're publishing our first issue, like a first like full issue with like essays and other kinds of work in it. So that's online. And then other than that, I'm working on, I just have some exhibitions in New York. And then I have a book of some collected writing that's coming out, but not until like early 2022. And yeah, I think it's kind of the main stuff.